Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. As I've said on several previous occasions, I have forced myself over the years to read something called the Anglican Journal, the journal that was actually a newspaper. And I find the extreme left-wing views there so appalling. I'm not at all surprised that the Anglican Church is rapidly losing members and, according to one of their own projections, will basically be out of existence in Canada by 2040 if there's not some sort of revival. And many parishes are reduced basically to older people who've been with the church all their lives, and it's just something that they don't want to change. But anyway, this is from the Anglican Journal of April of last year. Our people are still so much in need of healing. The new coordinator of the Anglican Healing Fund on residential schools, trauma and recovery. Now, there hasn't been a residential school in operation for over 30 years. And the boo-hoo-hoo-hooing that's been going on, just a form of moral masturbation. Were some things done wrong at those schools? Yeah, of course. Were there some individual cases of sexual, perhaps other forms of abuse? Yes, on occasion there were. And that's a bad thing. But this is being turned into an orgy of white guilt. In fact, saying that the schools had no value at all, that was a big point in an attack on Canadian Senator Lynn Bayak several years ago, where she said, and she put this up on her website, that many natives had said that the residential schools had basically given them the tools, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, maybe a little bit of home economics or industrial arts, a bit of science, that allowed them to participate in modern society. And the challenge the Dominion government had beginning in 1885 was, how do we ease a Stone Age people, largely, into at least the edge of the modern world, so they can participate. many of them were hunter-gatherers, nomadic people. And where they were not already being educated in larger areas, what the government did was bring them together, the children, into residential schools, which they would attend for 10 or so months of the year. This involved separation from their families. Well, you know, that's tough, no doubt about it. And while there was abuse in some cases, this was not the overall trend, but it is being demonized, and of course huge, huge financial payouts. Anyway, the Anglican Church ran some of these. Here's a little bit from the Anglican Journal. Last November, there was a new leader of the Anglican Church of Canada's national office, Martha Many Gray Horses. Martha Many Gray Horses has arrived to take up her new role as coordinator of the Anglican Healing Fund, which gives grants to support the recovery of Indigenous people from the Indian residential school system. So this is Martha Many Gray Horses. Now, you've got to understand, any Indian who attended these schools has already received an automatic payout. That's $10,000 if they spend even one day in a school. And then I think it's something like $3,000 more for each additional year they spend. So if they were there, say, from grades 1 through to grade 10, that would be $10,000 plus 9 times 3, would that be another $37,000. Now, somehow the Anglican Church is also giving away more money. And no wonder the church is in severe decline. Many Gray Horses, what does she have to... She says, what attracted you to this position? The word healing, because I've traveled the road before and continue to travel it in terms of my personal healing and in terms of reaching out to help my peers. In the 80s, I did a lot of work in communities in Western Canada as a consultant on community development. Which residential school did you attend? She's asked. It was the St. Paul's Anglican Indian Residential School, and it was located on my reserve, which is in Alberta. I was going through suffering at the residential school, and it was starting to get really unbearable. They used corporal punishment, but then other schools did back then too. And she goes on about that. My father especially, we didn't live that far from the school, so I ran through the fields. My father especially understood why I had been talking about it for some time before I ran away. I didn't tell him I was going to run away, but I did anyway. So the next day, they went to see the Anglican minister, and my father made up his mind that he wasn't going to let me go back. And I agreed that I would miss school. And she went to a regular high school, public high school. So, but you know, story solved. It wasn't working out for her. She wasn't forced to go. Certain minority groups sense the vulnerability of many Christian and white Canadians to guilt. And the vulnerability to be absolutely hornswoggled on this. Well, here's a very interesting, I think very pertinent and timely little editorial by Diane Francis of the Financial Post. China must be brought to heel, she says. Canada needs a prime minister who will stand up to China and hold him accountable for the untold damage this pandemic has caused the world. Instead, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau sanctimoniously says that now is not the time for criticism, but for international cooperation. Sounds good. Yeah, international cooperation. Except they haven't been cooperating. How bloody naive, and Diane Francis says. Is this about statesmanship or getting China's endorsement for a seat on the United Nations Security Council, which of course is the burning ambition of our trust fund kid? Peking is a bully and a rogue nation that claws it, that thumbs its nose at global norms, laws and institutions. It attempts to cover up the COVID-19 epidemic. It's latest and most destructive in a long list of harmful actions that include abuses against Hong Kong and Taiwan, trade cheating, monumental pollution, and technology theft. International cooperation was not what the People's Republic of China had in mind when its leadership hid the COVID-19 scourge from the world in the fall, then locked down an entire province, but not its international airports until weeks later. So they continued in a way to export it. Or if you want to be more benign or less judgmental, let it escape to the rest of the world while they were locking down Hubei province to prevent it from getting out to the rest of China. Okay, quote, this will go down as the biggest cover-up in world history, said White House trade advisor Peter Navarro in an interview with CNN. On January 15th, China came here and signed a trade deal, and nobody told us that there was a human-to-human transmission and the possibility of a pandemic. China hid the virus from the world, and while they did, went from a net exporter of personal protective equipment to importing it. Now they are profiteering from that. And this is a White House trade representative, Peter Navarro. If China were a Canadian corporation, nobody would do business with it, and its partners and clients would be in court suing for detrimental reliance. This is what the words, actions or inactions of one party misled others to their detriment. China is thoroughly untrustworthy, according to a recent report by the Five Eyes Alliance, of which Canada is a member, which claimed that China orchestrated an elaborate COVID-19 cover-up that included destroying evidence, silencing officials, scrubbing the internet, and launching a propaganda campaign. The Five Eyes are Canada, the United States, England, New Zealand, and Australia. And it involves elaborate electronic spying around the world, or monitoring, if you prefer that term. Meanwhile, Canada says and does nothing, while Australia demands an international inquiry and European and Americans contemplate reparations. Missouri has already sued China for damages, and other states are likely to follow suit. U.S. President Donald Trump has suggested that America should seek $10 million per fatality. But that's hardly enough, says Diane Francis. In response, China's propagandists have launched vicious counterattacks, ridiculing those who suggest the country is somehow liable by accusing them of incompetence, threatening to halt imports, and trotting out a conspiracy theory that the Americans developed the virus as a bioweapon. It's clear that international cooperation, at least when it comes to dealing with China, doesn't work. North America must therefore decouple itself from Peking. This means banning Chinese ownership in key industries, and I've urged that for a long time myself. Encouraging the repatriation or relocation of manufacturing from China. Yeah, bring our manufacturing back. Stop relying on them, because the bottom line is you can't rely on them. Locking Huawei from continuing contributing to our 5G network, stopping the flood of mainland Chinese students who come here to acquire knowledge that will eventually be used against us, and removing all Chinese representation from international institutions until amends are made. Yeah, play tough hardball. China is currently constituted deserves to be treated like Russian athletes who dope in order to win gold medals. They should be disqualified and vilified. There's also the deliberate attacks she concludes, China should have been brought to heel years ago. Instead, oil jobs have been lost, Canadian agribusiness damaged by cancelled contracts, Canada's workforce gutted by cheap Chinese labor and dumping. Two innocent Canadians have been jailed for well over a year out of spite, and a Trojan horse of Chinese paid lobbyists and influencers have been unleashed here. The only way to change this is by fortifying North America, says Diane Francis. And I think the general thrust of that column is absolutely right. And this is from Rebel Media. They say, we're taking Trudeau to court. Justin Trudeau is censoring Rebel News, so we're taking him to court again. You see, given the coronavirus pandemic, the only way to get access to the Prime Minister is to call into his morning pajama briefings. For weeks, my Rebel News colleagues and I have called in to put a question to Trudeau himself, but we've been rejected every single time. The only reporters who are getting a word in are friendly to Trudeau, his state-funded CBC stenographers, like-minded reporters from the Canadian press, and left-wing freelancers. Trudeau has either ordered the censorship of Rebel News, or he's relying on sympathetic state bureaucrats to shelter him from tough questions. And Ezra Levant says, I'm not sure which is worse. He's the head of Rebel News. Nevertheless, I've had it, and I'm not taking it anymore. We are now suing the Privy Council Office, that's the supposedly nonpartisan government bureaucracy, to get Trudeau's civil servants to stop this illegal filtering of government information. We're suing them because it's the only way to get results in this country. I think it'll take a judge to remind Trudeau that this is not communist China. This is Canada, and no prime minister or bureaucrat gets to decide who holds the government accountable. Our democracy depends on it. Don't you think that, actually this is written by Keen Bexty, who's a reporter for the Rebel. And then here is a more complete account of what they are doing here. I'm trying to get this this broadcast up for you here. We do have our problems sometimes here.
In our Constitution. The Prime Minister does not get to decide, does not get to cherry pick which reporters are allowed to ask questions and which reporters are just censored entirely. That is unacceptable. That is how Vladimir Putin operates. That is how Xi Jinping operates. That is not how Justin Trudeau should operate. This is a major problem, not just for Rebel News, not just for me, but for every Canadian. This is not the first time that Justin Trudeau has acted like a coward. If you were following me during the federal election, you saw me crisscrossing the country trying to get into positions where I could ask the Prime Minister questions. Real questions. Tough questions. Uncomfortable questions. Questions that the mainstream media would not ask. Whether it was on the street side in Montreal when the police were interrogating me for trying to talk to the Prime Minister, or whether it was in an event, or whether it was at the leaders' debate, I was asking questions that the mainstream media simply refused to ask. The mainstream media is corrupt. This was never more apparent than during the federal election, when I had to sue to get access to the federal leaders' debate. We had important questions to ask about SNC-Lavalin, about blackface, about Justin Trudeau's groping victim in British Columbia. We had questions to ask that the mainstream media refused to ask. During the federal leaders' debate, we asked questions of every single leader, including Justin Trudeau. And some of those leaders decided not to answer me. And that was fine. That was their right. And they looked like fools because of it. We have questions that our viewers need answers to. It's not a vanity contest. I don't want to speak to the Prime Minister out of pride. I can think of much better ways to spend my time. I want to speak to the Prime Minister. I want the opportunity to ask him questions because our viewers have questions that need answers. We have questions that will expose Justin Trudeau as a puppet of China. We have questions that will expose his administration as corrupt and negligent. But because we're not able to ask the questions, because Justin Trudeau's bureaucracy is shielding him from us, we have launched another lawsuit. If you've been watching Justin Trudeau's morning press conferences, some people call them press conferences, I prefer to call it the Trudeau Morning Show, because that's what it is. It's a facade. It is an opportunity for Justin Trudeau's favorite reporters to ask the Prime Minister questions. Reporters who are never going to ask a critical question and never have asked critical questions in their lives. You can see the questions for yourself. Listen to this.
Yesterday, your plan was to detain migrants crossing into Canada in federal facilities. Now you're planning to send them back to the U.S., where they may be interned in ICE detention facilities and potentially even deported back to South America. Is that wise?
Do you think that's wise? That was an actual question asked by someone who pretends to be a reporter. Followed up after that on Monday was a reporter from Bloomberg. Yes, that very same Bloomberg, asking about the genitalia of the newly appointed governor of the Bank of Canada. Like that is some sort of issue, some pressing issue right now. Listen to this.
So I have a very quick question regarding the Bank of Canada nomination. You've been committed to more equality and diversity across government positions. Why did your government decide to follow the same model by nominating another English-speaking man to the role instead of a francophone or a woman?
The way the Trudeau Morning Show works is two questions in English get asked and two questions in French get asked on the phone. And what I've noticed is the French questions, the reporters and the outlets, they get cycled through much more rapidly. There's a smaller pool of French reporters who the Privy Council Office have deemed acceptable to ask the Prime Minister questions, or there's just less calling in. At one point in March, near the end of the month, a reporter was selected 3 consecutive days. On any given day, Le Devoir, La Presse, or La Presse Canadienne get chosen to ask the Prime Minister a question. These questions are valuable, they're important, and they always blow it. The questions they ask are almost never substantial. So I decided to call in on the French line. I wasn't getting anywhere on the English line. I called in almost a dozen times there. So I called in on the French line. I practiced my question, my name and introduction in French. And on that day, they, instead of selecting a variety of reporters, which were certainly there, I was calling in, they selected 2 reporters from the same outlet, Le Devoir. Now I've called in on the French line, I've called in on the English line, my colleagues have called in as well, and they've never been selected. And I know journalists from other outlets like True North have been calling in as well. They've never been selected as well. Just like in October when we sued the Federal Debates Commission, a commission that was supposed to be neutral, supposed to be nonpartisan, so that everyone had a fair shot at it, both the politicians and the reporters. We are now suing Justin Trudeau's Privy Council Office. If you don't know what that is, it's the bureaucracy that is adjacent to the Prime Minister's office. It's actually in the same Langevin Block building. They're supposed to be neutral, but they do the bidding of the Prime Minister's office, and it is clear that they have selected a pool of reporters who are acceptable to ask the Prime Minister's questions. Now, every reporter should be able to have access to the Prime Minister. It is in our Constitution. The Prime Minister does not get to decide, does not get to cherry pick which reporters are allowed to ask questions and which reporters are just censored entirely. That is unacceptable. That is how Vladimir Putin operates. That is how Xi Jinping operates. That is not how Justin Trudeau should operate. This is a major problem, not just for Rebel News, not just for me, but for every Canadian. Every Canadian deserves to be able to have their Prime Minister held accountable. But right now, Justin Trudeau is held in a nice little sanitary bubble designed and made for him by the Privy Council Office, an organization that should be nonpartisan, that should be indifferent to the political success of Justin Trudeau. That is why we're suing. You can help Rebel News out by going to letusreport.com. There you can sign a petition and pitch in to help our legal funds. It will cost surely tens of thousands.
And it's sad that there actually has to be a lawsuit to achieve basic rights. Well, one of the problems the coronavirus has brought to us is that there's been massive infections at several meatpacking plants in Alberta and of course in the United States as well, and one wonders why, because superficially most of these workers should not be particularly vulnerable. I mean, they're relatively young and one would imagine relatively healthy if they're able to do this fairly demanding physical work. Well, what's happening? Well, at least in Canada and the United States, but especially in Canada, the vast majority of these people are from the third world. And of course, you have to read it very, very, very carefully. But in a report on the big slaughterhouse, the Cargill slaughterhouse in High River, Alberta, which is opening up again. After a short shutdown, this is part of the report that was in the Monday, May 4th Globe and Mail. Alberta is home to the two largest COVID-19 outbreaks. The first at Cargill's operation High River, and the second at JBS Canada's beef processing facility in Brooks, Alberta. A Globe and Mail investigation into the cargo outbreak revealed an environment in which employees who are largely immigrant and temporary foreign workers said they felt pressure to work even as the COVID-19 cases continued to rise. Now, you know, the alarm bells go off, or the disconnect bells go off. Temporary foreign workers. Now, we were assured that when this matter blew up in 2014 and 15 by the former Conservative Harper government, when they got burned with this temporary foreign workers thing, at a time when unemployment was over 6%, we had nearly 500,000 temporary foreign workers. You wonder, well, what are they doing the Canadians can't or won't do? Well, now, the Harper government promised to reform and make it much tougher for employers to bring in temporary foreign workers, and they would have to prove that they advertised and no Canadian was able to do the job. Now, work in meatpacking plants is hard and dirty work. But it's equally difficult to believe that no Canadians can do the job. Well, more likely what it is that wages are very low and it may be difficult for to get Canadians to work at such low wages in what's a hard, dirty job. And there's a big difference. Temporary foreign workers has been a program used by many employers to basically keep wages low. You can get third worlders, at least temporarily, to work for much lower wages than Canadians. at a dirty job. That basically just allows the employers to circumvent what ought to be a competitive job market. And in a case like that, if you cannot get people to work for, let's say, the minimum wage plus a buck or two at a hard, dirty job, then you what would you have to do? Well, the employer would have to raise the wages. Yes, and I know the howl of protest, yes, but they would have to charge more for the meat. Well, that may well be true. And perhaps that's the price we might want to be prepared to pay, because there have been repeated public health problems at Canadian abattoirs because of third world labor. Some of these people do not have the, to be quite blunt about it, do not have the same health standards as Canadians, or as many Canadians, may not follow instructions as well about, you know, that basically washing one's hands repeatedly. Yes, in close quarters, this COVID-19 or Wuhan flu virus can spread, and it apparently has in the meatpacking plants. But a lack of maintaining good health standards is also a key part of this. And then, continuing on this article, in recent days, the union was actually opposed to reopening the Cargill site. The union conducted a poll and sent it to Cargill workers in four languages. Four languages. Well, English and French are the official languages of Canada. Let us assume that French was one of the four languages. We'll make the big assumption that English was one. Why are these people even working in Canada if they can't function in English? And that may also be one of the problems here. One temporary foreign worker has died who worked at a Cargill plant in High River. This woman was a Vietnamese, and her name was Heep, H-I-E-P. Mrs. Heep, the Cargill employee who died, was in her 60s and worked at the Alberta meatpacking plant for more than two decades. Her death 2 weeks ago has left her husband, Noyen Gnaw, uncertain of his future. And Miss Heap came from Ba, Rio Vung Tau, a coastal province in southern Vietnam. She and her husband arrived in Canada in 1992 and settled in the Calgary area. She's barely worked for various employees, but ended up working at Cargill. Now, this begs some questions. First of all, she was not no spring chicken. She was 60, in her 60s. Not even quite sure how old, but she was in her 60s and may well have had other medical conditions that made her vulnerable to the coronavirus. Once again, this seems to be something of an immigration story, or a poorly screened immigration story. And the fact that the government continues to allow employers to get away with circumventing fair labor practices and hiring Canadians. Well, Antonio Guterres is the UN Secretary General. And he was in Tanzania, and on Friday he said that the coronavirus pandemic keeps unleashing, quote, a tsunami of hate and xenophobia, scapegoating and scaremongering. Of hate. Well, by that he appears to mean nationalists who are leery of foreigners bringing the coronavirus to their shores. This would not seem to me to be particularly bad behavior, but it certainly is for Guterres, who is an extreme leftist. The UN chief said anti-foreigner sentiment has surged online and in the streets. Anti-Semitic conspiracy theories have spread, and COVID-19 related anti-Muslim attacks have occurred. I'd like to know more information about all that. Anti-foreigner sentiment. Well, sometimes foreigners are the ones who brought it. In the case of Canada, it was Chinese visitors or returning travelers who were Chinese who'd been to the Wuhan area and less numerously, but still a contributing factor. People who'd been to another hotbed of the coronavirus, which was Iran. So, yeah, people have every reason to have concerns about some foreigners. These are not irrational. Now that shouldn't mean that people go around beating people. Of course, Guterres said, migrants and refugees, those would be illegals, have been vilified as a source of the virus. Well, in some cases, they are. And then he goes on to say, he called on the media, especially social media, to remove racist, misogynist, and other harmful content. Here we come down to that old communist fallback, and that is censorship. It's all very much an open definition of what is racist or misogynist content. Well, basically, anything he doesn't like. And I ask everyone everywhere to stand up against hate. Hate, or as is often applied in these arguments, hate speech, is basically speech or views that the speaker hates, the accuser. With rising ethno-nationalism and populism, and authoritarianism and a pushback against human rights in some countries, the crisis can provide a pretext to adopt repressive measures. Well, he's all over the landscape there, and a pretext to apply repressive measures. Well, that's certainly what's happening in places like Canada. And I'll be talking a little bit about a very sad, disturbing article I saw in my own local paper here in Hamilton when I returned from Western Canada today. But this is another good old whack against nationalism. People like Guterres, a great internationalist, doesn't like strong nationalism, which puts the interests of one's own country first, which is only healthy, being healthy. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighty side of me. Gonna take a little bit of a change of pace here and play some tunes by a man who brought the country's, a particular country sound of Bakersfield, California. Actually brought to California by the Okies. Those are the people from driven out of places, particularly like Oklahoma, by the Dust Bowl. And They developed their own type of country music in and around Bakersfield. This is Buck Owens. Thank you.
My dreams and plans. Now the pace we're living dream come true. And my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know your mind till the end of time makes my heart skip a come through, and my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees, and just to know your mind till the end of time makes my heart skip a beat. Together again, my tears have stopped falling. The long, lonely nights are now at an end. The key to my heart you hold in your hand, and nothing else matters. We're together again. Yes. just long as you love me. I don't care if the world don't turn. I don't care if the fire don't burn. Just as long as you love me.
Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow here on altrighttv.com or what, resistanceradio.com. This is Paul Fromm, and I sign off tonight as I always do with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, entwine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.